Jobs and immigration reform are just two of the issues that are at stake in this election. What happens this November really matters.
America is one of the highest tax nations in the world. Reducing taxes will cause new companies and new jobs to come roaring back into our country.
I know that there's a lot of angst about all the changes that are happening in the world, technology, globalization. I understand all that.
One of the greatest job killers of them all, excessive regulation, is costing our country as much as $2 trillion a year.
So I want to cut red tape, increase access to capital, and invest $25 billion to support innovations in the communities that need that the most.
Hillary Clinton's message is that things will never change, never ever. My message is that things have to change, and they have to change right now.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, an interesting week full of, gosh, all kinds of news, including on this Friday. Last Friday when we ended the show, in fact, in the middle of the show, we had a military coup in Turkey. This Friday, we have another terrorist attack with eight individuals and others wounded in Germany. And of course, the markets are still holding up, although we're seeing a pullback in commodities. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Joining me in the first hour will be Gary Dorsch. He's still bullish on the stock market. He thinks this bull's got more to run. He also thinks that any pullback in gold is a good buying opportunity. And of course, Ned Schmidt will be joining us as we talk about the commodity complex. And Ned is bullish on fundamentals all across the board for commodities from ags to energy to precious metals. Ryan Poplava will be here to join us in the first hour talking about what moved the markets this week. There was a lot of things going on, including speculation about Fed interest rates to corporate earnings. All of that in hour one.
And I'm John Loeffler. Well, thunka-thunka-thunka-thunka-thunka, you can hear it coming. Helicopter money, at least that seems to be where the central banks are going in the midst of rising debt and an oncoming financial crisis, which isn't imminently right here. After the last financial crisis, people applauded the Fed. We didn't have a 1930-style depression, but we're sort of jammed here as far as much improvement, and taxes and regulation are still impacting the economy. So in the midst of all of that, what is it the Democratic and Republican platforms are saying about what they wish to do? And here's a clue for both of them. They want to spend money, which leads us to the second part of the big picture, fiscal fairy tales and fantasies. We seem to be in a very weird world where, if you look at what Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff is saying, unfunded liability for Medicare and Social Security combined is $199 trillion. But you don't hear them talking about that in the campaign. So we have to look at what the real fiscal condition of the U.S. is versus what the candidates might think it is. All of that coming up today. It's going to be interesting on the big picture right here on the Financial Sense News Hour. But first, it's over to Ryan Poplava. And Ryan, heat wave continuing outdoors in the Midwest. It's been pretty hot in the Southwest. Pacific Northwest, unseasonably cool summer. But as far as things heating up, there is no stopping the stocks on fire in the United States, hitting fresh record closes during this last week at some point for the S&P 500 and the Dow Industrials. And we continue to see that improvement continues with year-to-date highs in the Russell Small Cap Index and the NASDAQ Composite. So the rally is really hot. Is there anything that might cool it down? Will investors step into the shade and take some cool off from the already substantial rally of the June post-Brexit lows? What do you think? It's anything but a usual year.
Yeah, and we've talked a lot about that, the Brexit referendum and the effects of that. Then all of a sudden, this rally out of the blue, just moments when we thought that this market was going to correct even more and more worry over Brexit. It's really quite amazing. But no, John, I obviously I don't have a crystal ball, but there has been some discussion off the institutional trading desks I talk to. We've got, you know, two Bloombergs here where we've got instant chat messages to a lot of the trading desks we deal with, both on bonds and equities. And also some of the research I read, a lot of it is saying that some of the catalysts used to really justify the advance, and there was a whole long list of them. I really discussed them last week in detail. The feeling is that some of those catalysts are starting to get long in the tooth, and other headwinds are beginning to present themselves now that we didn't see as a situation just a month ago or a couple weeks ago. A Fed that may try to change its tone next week when they meet and give their policy update. Based on some of the more solid economic reports we have been getting, obviously the jobs report was a big component of that. There's been others, though, as I've been saying since May, and also the financial calm that we have essentially seen post the Brexit issues. You know, the discussion that many are having regarding some of these articles out recently over the last 2 weeks regarding more monetary stimulus out of Europe. We talked about that last week. We talked about Ben Bernanke being over there in Japan. And Japan, obviously, a lot of talk there combining fiscal stimulus with monetary stimulus. So we've had these catalysts, essentially, that a lot of the trading desks are discussing, the media are discussing, both pieces of the puzzle, essentially the monetary stimulus, things out of Europe and Japan, could possibly predict a higher U.S. dollar. And essentially, a higher U.S. dollar would put pressure on commodities, put pressure on oil, which is a barometer that many use, copper as well, a fundamental economic barometer. And then, obviously, the earnings for multinationals, which have been really hurt by the strong dollar over the past 2 years. The dollar is now trading back clearly above its 200-day moving average at 97.39 on the dollar index, John. And that's not the trade-weighted dollar, which a lot of fundamentalists might use. That's not the same dollar index that the markets use, that traders use, that investors are looking at. And that dollar index, the one I'm discussing, has 50% weighting in euros, 13% in yen, 11% in pound. And all three of those central banks are saying we're willing to do more, or they're dangling the carrot. Just next month, they're going to do more. The Central Bank of Europe met this week, didn't change rates, but said they're willing to do more if they have to. Yeah, I think they're obviously trying to bide time, but from all the articles we've been reading, they're trying to lean. The bias is that they're going to be doing more, whereas we're starting to hear now on the Fed, some articles recently, the bias is that the market's estimates of a rate hike this year are probably too low. So, you know, when you look at oil down to $44.20 for September delivery, you know why it's down. It's because of the dollar. Despite the drawdown on inventories we heard this week from the American Petroleum Institute announced just this week, the point is the dollar is strengthening, and that has been a headwind in the past, and that's starting to present itself, and there's starting to be some discussion about that.
So as I'm hearing you, I guess you're expecting things to cool off while the market actually continues to hit new highs. Now, seems like something's missing from your view here. I mean, right?
Yeah, you know, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to sound bearish, and I'm not trying to say, hey, the markets are going to reverse.
Okay.
There have always been fundamental concerns over this market. We've been talking about it since November, and valuation concerns continue. They started from last year. So earnings are out, and there's a heck of a lot of surprising going on. And in fact, if I just look at my little scorecard here of the 125 companies that are reported for Q2, in the S&P 500, 80% have beaten earnings estimates and 60% have beaten sales estimates. So you typically, when a company announces and estimates were at a certain point and they beat, typically these stocks do well and the market responds favorably with bidding prices higher. Historically, you know, that's the rates I just gave you, the 80% on earnings, 60% on sales, those beats are actually historically really good. That's above the recent averages we've been seeing. And obviously, some of my fundamental concerns have been over earnings, the decline that we've been seeing year over year for three quarters in a row. But, you know, actual earnings estimates, interestingly enough, have actually fallen recently. So from July 1st to now, second quarter estimates have actually fallen. It was estimated a decline of 4.9%. They've fallen now down to 5.2 in just the past few weeks. And for the third quarter, they've fallen from 2.7% growth. Now it's a little bit more moderate at 1.8% growth. So in that time where earning estimates are actually falling, the market's gone up 3%. So I totally acknowledge that there isn't an earnings-driven rally here. It's a more of a hope, a PE multiple expansion rally based on money leaving abroad, coming here. Some have said a yield-induced rally as a result of really, really low treasury yields. So economics have been good, and I've been saying that for months, but earnings have definitely been given a, I would say, a positive spin. Regardless, you know, John, markets are hanging in very strong, and the technical reports I continue to see are predicting much higher highs in our future. So, you know, there's the fundamental versus technical. That debate is definitely going on.
Yeah, so there is fundamental versus technical battles going on. What do you think? Technical's winning?
Yeah, you know, based on money movement, positioning, sentiment, price itself is now becoming the discussion, right? You and I, every week, we're talking about where the market is. The market's up. New all-time highs. You know, that's bullish, and I said that last week. I said it the week before. Investors mainly have a neutral bias right now on sentiment. We're not too greedy. They're not too fearful. Right there, neutral. So things can continue to go up. We can get extended, and investors might go from finally neutral to maybe a little euphoric. Who knows? We're not there yet. But I'd say quite a bit of short covering has been done based on some of the volume flows I'm looking at. They definitely dropped off this week, which doesn't mean the market's going to turn negative. Doesn't mean it's going to go down. But I think the immediate volume thrust we got with the breakout that encouraged short covering, I think that's leveling off based on the evidence that I'm seeing here. But speaking of flows, John, we're getting just an influx of orders for our insider service, which Chris Sheridan does a lot of the interviews with our guests and Jim as well. This one was with Martin Armstrong on Friday, was released. And he basically summarizes those very points I just mentioned. He's of the opinion that we're going higher, not based on just economics, which are fairly decent alone, but from investor flows. And, you know, just speaking of fundamental versus technical, it's funny. John, I was just looking at this morning. My brother sent it to me. Say you get a technical analyst and a fundamental analyst chatting about the markets in a kitchen. Accidentally, one of them knocks a kitchen knife off the table, landing right in the fundamental analyst's foot. The fundamental analyst yells at the technician, asking him why he didn't catch the knife. And he said, you know, technicians don't catch falling knives. So the technician turns to the fundamental analyst and says, why didn't you just move your foot out of the way? Fundamental analyst responds, I didn't think it could go that low. We've got an ongoing joke here at our office about, you know, fundamental analysts. As things get cheaper, if you recall the financial debacle in 2008, but you know that actually started with financials in 2006 and 2007, and how every time we saw on the media, you know, CNBC and many others, analysts saying banks are cheap, they continued to get cheaper. So, anyways, you know, fundamental versus technical, we had a little bit of fun with that today.
Yeah. Now, if I could only turn that into, yeah, it's all right. We'll let it go. Anyway. So, Ryan, fundamentally, what's technically on the docket for next week?
Technically speaking, we get some economic indicators. So I guess not as fundamental. We'll get some information on Japan, such as the trade data. And Japan's a very big interest with all the stories going on. Bernanke there. Is there stimulus, monetary, fiscal? So we'll get some data next week. The PMI data, the purchasing manager's data, that came out this week looked like some weakness in July for UK. While other European countries are doing better, the UK number hit a 7-year low. So we'll get eventually some more PMI data following all this, but definitely fundamentals continue. They're still important. we're moving at all these highs and earnings are dropping. We've got some nice earnings surprises. It's not so much what the news is, it's how the market responds to the news. Technical and price are always, you know, the most important thing for investors. But obviously, we need to back that up. But going on, in the docket ahead, we've got essentially the catalyst will be the Fed meeting on Tuesday and Wednesday, policy on Wednesday, and then the Bank of Japan on Thursday. There's been a lot of discussion on, as I said, both over the past 2 weeks. So Catalyst Day is coming on those two fronts. And by the way, I forgot to mention John Hilzenrath on the Fed.
Oh, yeah. John Hilzenrath, the guy at the WSJ, Wall Street Journal, that has the pulse on the Fed. I guess sooner or later we needed to talk about him.
Yeah, he's been missing from some of our talks. But no, he wrote an article this week that the Fed has been encouraged by the market results and economic results that a rate hike this year is growing. as I already mentioned. So basically, when we hear from the Fed next week, you know, I'm going to be really keyed in and looking at if they adjust, obviously, their view. As I mentioned quite a few weeks ago about the minutes, there was like 30 plus uncertainties that were written in there. You know, I guess we're going to have to count how many uncertainties again this next week as we look through the tea leaves, as they say. So that's for the next week. And of course, mornings and the probability so far continue the trend of better than average number of earnings surprises and sales surprises than normal.
All right. Well, it is interesting times. Next week, the Democratic Convention is going to present their platform. They've got it in draft right now, but they haven't finalized and formalized it, so to speak. So we'll see. And Jim and I are going to be discussing the impact of both Republican and Democratic platforms on economies and investors. So anyway, Ryan Poplawa is going to be interesting now through the fall, I would aver. So look forward to seeing you again next week.
Yeah, we'll have a lot to talk about with the central banks. Looking forward to it.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplawa or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Joining us on the show today is Martin Armstrong of Armstrong Economics, creator of the popular economic confidence model and a speaker of the widely attended World Economic Conferences. Martin, before we discuss your upcoming conference in November and the best way that our listeners can attend, I want to ask you about a recent blog post where you talk about how Germany has now sold 10-year bonds at a negative yield. And I believe this is a first for Eurozone nation. Why is this so important and show, as you write, that a real crisis is brewing?
In Europe, there is this popular belief that if they buy the German bonds, when the euro crashes, they're going to get Deutsche Marks. The euro is, it's just not a viable currency. Normally, if there was a problem in Greece or Italy, etc., what happens is the currency is automatically devalued. When the currency cannot do that, then what happens? You have bond defaults, things of this nature. The pressure has to go someplace. The net effect is the dollar is the only place to go right now for world capital. And you have to look at it from a perspective of major institutions, you know, pension funds, things of this nature, insurance companies. Most of these pension funds need 8% to break even. You're talking about interest rates being negative, right? There is no more opportunity effectively to buy bonds. And they're shifting out of government debt, selling it off, and they're buying corporate. They need some yield. You can't be negative. The stock market ends up being the only place that international capital can go. When you're trying to run away from currencies that are becoming destabilized, you're talking about bonds going negative, and they're worried about if the euro breaking up. So the traditional idea of the stock market going up is, oh, people, you know, are interested in PE ratio and what's income, etc. No, at this stage in the game, it moves to, I just want to park my money.
The stock market seems to be going up to new records. Doesn't matter what's happening to the economy or corporate earnings, money has been pouring into the market. Is this the next leg of a bull run? Joining us on the program is Gary Dorsch. Gary, let's begin with the S&P 500. It is out of the blue. It seemed like it was going to be a dismal year. We had a couple of pullbacks. But as we look at right now, the stock market is heading higher, or looks like it wants to head higher.
Well, it's been a remarkable turnaround from just 3 weeks ago. 3 weeks ago, we had the vote on Brexit, and that was a major shock. 9 opinion polls in England before the vote had signaled that the pollsters felt that they all agreed that they would vote to stay in the European Union. And when England voted to leave the European Union, it caused a major shock. The S&P dropped about 5% down to the 2000 level. And there was about $4 trillion of equities wiped off of global stock markets in a two-day rout as of June 27th, the Dow falling 1,000 points and the S&P falling 5%. But since then, there's been a dramatic turnaround. The volatility is just beyond belief. And we have seen now the Dow Industrials rebound 1,560 points off that low from June 27th. And the S&P, as we sit here Thursday midday, at 2,173. So that is an all-time record high that exceeds last year's high of 2,135. So that makes this the second longest duration bull market in history, almost 7.5 years old now. And it comes at a time when we've had five consecutive quarters of declining profitability for the S&P 500 companies. On a cumulative level, profits are down about 18% from where they were five quarters ago. And so it is remarkable, given the relative stability of the market, the resiliency, despite an earnings recession. And of course, most of the earnings recession is in the energy sector and raw materials, and some anemic profits in the financials. But we did see two corrections of 10% or more in the last 12 months. That helped to wipe off some of the overzealous froth from the previous bull run that we had earlier, prior to the Fed suspending QE. So some people are saying, well, we had two corrections in the last year. We had a 5% pullback with Brexit. So we're good to go now to explore to new high ground, because whatever worries we had are now behind us. We had shakeouts. We've consolidated. We're showing a lot of resiliency, even in the face of negative news. And instead, we have to ask just what is keeping this market so strong. And I think the areas that I have focused on is, number one, stock buybacks. The S&P 500 companies are funneling almost 70% of their net cash flow into buying their own stock and providing dividends. So that is remarkable. They have no other better way to spend their money than on their own shares and for their own shareholders. And also, most importantly, the most extraordinary amount of monetary stimulus that we have seen, even 8 years since the banking crisis began to unfold with the default of Lehman Brothers almost 8 years ago. Central banks are still at it, and it seems like a never-ending amount of stimulus coming down the pipeline. So we now have two central banks, the Bank of England, which had mothballed its QE money injection program back in November 2012, now basically signaling it's going to resume quantitative easing as early as next month in August. And next week, we may find out that the Bank of Japan wants to bump up the monthly size of its liquidity injections as well, expanding its QE. So this money is fungible, whether it's printed in London or in Tokyo. It can find its way anywhere in the world via carry trades and via the currency markets. So that huge tsunami of liquidity just never ceases to end. And of course, the Federal Reserve, which had been expected to raise interest rates by 1% this year, according to the dot plots report they put out in December, has reneged on that pledge. And apparently, they're not going to raise rates, according to most expectations, until after the November 8th election, so as not to roil the stock market before the upcoming elections here in the U.S. So you take all that together. Bad news is good news for the market, because it leads to expectations of more liquidity injections, rate cuts around the world, including some other countries like Korea and New Zealand, suggesting they will lower rates. So given the peripheral countries still easing up on their money policies, and ultimately this is what has, I believe, led to this situation that we see now.
Let me stop you there for a second. You talked about stock buybacks, companies using 70% of their cash flow to buy back stock. What about low interest rates? I mean, we saw last week the lowest interest rate on a 30-year bond in the Treasury's history. The same thing with the German Bund. How much is low interest rates as a result of these liquidity injections is sort of putting a floor underneath the market? I mean, if interest rates are at zero, or let's say one-third of sovereign debt is negative, where in the heck are you going to put your money? I mean, for the first time in my career, Gary, you can get a higher return, at least in terms of dividends, than you can in the bond market.
Well, that's true. Nearly $12 trillion of sovereign debt in Europe and Japan is now yielding less than 0%. and there's a several trillion yielding less than 1%. So you're right. This massive tsunami of liquidity not only is boosting stock prices, but also depressing bond yields to levels that would have been unimaginable even 5 years ago. I don't think anyone could have ever believed we would see interest rates under zero. It just was inconceivable. And so that is the reality, however, and so you're right. What alternatives do you have to negative interest rates? And so some of the stronger sectors in the U.S. stock market were the higher yielding utilities and the telecoms, which tend to pay out 4% dividend yields. They were the strongest sectors, while the industrials and the energy was going down. And they helped to offset some of the weakness there in the energy sector. Now we're starting to see a little bit flow into some of the industrial cyclical stocks because they've been underperforming the utilities. So you're right. What people are looking for now is utilizing stocks for their dividends, which is kind of a little risky thing. It's not really a bond. Stocks are not bonds. But in today's crazy world of QE, everything has been turned upside down. Normal traditional rules of investing no longer apply because of the wildly distortive impact of the manipulation of markets by the central banks have led to this highly crazy situation of negative rates as one of their tools. So just what is a person supposed to do? It is quite difficult because the P.E. ratios on the S&P have been stretched to very high levels, roughly 24 times trailing 12-month earnings. And that's well above the historical average of closer to 16. So they're not cheap either. But on the other hand, when you consider the alternative of negative interest rates overseas, that is the fair market price.
I'm going to come back to the stock market. We're at record levels with the Dow, same thing with the S&P 500. But Gary, the transports don't seem to be confirming the Dow. In other words, we don't have a new record for the transports. They're still below highs that were reached in August of last year. Does that trouble you in any way?
Not necessarily. I think what would make me be a little hesitant about entering, say, right now at this moment in time, is the VIX index, the volatility index, which is at near historic lows at under the 12 level for the S&P, for the OEX 100 at 11.84. That was just around 23, 24 after Brexit. And that is now at a level where there's an enormous amount of complacency, almost zero fear of risk. And contrarians will argue that that is more of a worrisome factor. Now, you can't use it for day-to-day or minute-to-minute timing. The VIX index can stay extraordinarily low for several days or weeks, but generally speaking, when you have such low levels of worry, that it's time to be a little bit worried that maybe something will come out of nowhere and cause a bit of a shakeout. We've had a heck of a run, 1,600 points on the Dow without a correction of any sort. That is extraordinary in itself, and especially at these record levels, given the age of the bull market. So it could very well suggest there'll be a pullback. Given that, I would say looking at the charts from a long-term view, if nothing else changes, if the Bank of Japan and the Bank of England decide to continue with their massive money injections and we continue to see the existence of negative rates and stock buybacks, the companies themselves can drive this market higher. They're the ones that have no fear of buying because it seems of no consequence. They're committed to these buybacks. So with that all said, I would say that the technicals, at least to me, look like we can still continue to go higher yet. So I'd be willing to put my neck on the chopping block and say that we could see the Dow at 20,000 sometime either by the end of this year or early next year, assuming all these other factors stay the same.
Let's talk about something that the market seems to be oblivious, and it surprised me in some ways, and that is geopolitical risk. We were doing the show last Friday. In the middle of the show, we had an attempted coup in Turkey. Now there's a clampdown. Looks like Erdogan is going to do to Turkey what the mullahs did to Iran. There doesn't seem to be any fear of geopolitical risk. We have problems in Nigeria with terrorists taking down the oil structure, taking oil offline. The markets seem to be complacent to any geopolitical risk, unlike what we've seen in the past, for example, in 2011 with the Arab Spring and things that were going on geopolitically.
the markets were sort of going in the opposite direction. Today, they seem to ignore this.
Well, QE and negative interest rates are the tonic for, I guess, what worries the markets. You might see more of that perhaps in the precious metals than you will in the equity markets. In regards to Turkey, yes, it's evolving into an Islamic dictatorship, and most worrisome is the number of nuclear weapons that are being stored at the Incirlik air base there in Turkey. Who is going to ultimately control those? And just how far Erdogan will go with his takeover, and will it involve perhaps a takeover of those weapons? If that was to happen, then maybe the whole situation would turn upside down very quickly into a big panic. So other than that, the geopolitical events are not enough to, you know, shake the market into a panic so far.
Let's talk about gold. I mean, in a negative interest rate world where you actually have to pay the government if you loan them money, it just seems to me it just provides a great backdrop for the price of gold because rates are so low. I mean, I can remember when gold hit 850 back in, what was it, 1980, 81. But then interest rates got up to 15.5% on treasuries. That's certainly not the case today. You've got 10-year treasuries at 1.6%. You've got a third of the sovereign bonds at negative interest rates, and there seems to be no end in sight. I was looking at almost 40% of short-term government bonds in the world are at negative interest rates. Does this not provide an ideal backdrop for gold?
Well, I do believe this is what has helped the gold market to its best year in quite some time. And you can go back to January 29th when the Bank of Japan made the shock announcement that they were going to move into the realm of negative interest rates. And that's when the gold market began to take off. And while that's important, is the majority of the sovereign bonds that are negative yielding are in Japan. Japan has the world's second largest bond market, and all the maturity out to 20 years is at 0% or less. So Japan is at the epicenter of the negative interest rate world, and that is why the gold market took off when Japan joined Europe in enforcing negative rates. That being said, the world economy is slowing down, and apparently, despite all these massive money injections and rate cuts, we hear the world economy is still slowing down. It could be the overhang of the massive amount of debt that companies have to deal with and to pay off is weighing on the world economy. And while that's important, is it does maybe possibly put a lid on commodity prices and therefore, you know, contains the inflationary pressure that's in the world economy. So gold has a positive from the negative interest rates and the money injections. And on the other hand, if the world economy is slowing down and commodity prices remain anemic or sort and don't advance much more than we've seen in recent weeks, then that could weigh on the gold market. My guess is that gold is going to hold support in around the 1300 level. That's what I wrote in my newsletter last Friday, 1300 to 1310. We hit the 1310 this morning and we just bounced $20 off the 1310 level now at 1330 as I'm speaking. So that's a good sign technically. That looks like we're in the sideways range between 1310 and 1370. My guess is it's now in a bull market. I think gold was in a 4.5 to 5 year bear market, and I think we saw the bottom of that bear market back in December and January. And this huge run-up is really a signal that there's a change in the cycle, and it's turned positive. And the cycle could last for several years. And therefore, I think investors will want to look for opportunities to buy on pullbacks, and eventually we'll break out of this range to the upside. 1400 or higher will be where we'll eventually go, because it doesn't seem as though the Fed will be raising rates anytime soon. And we're just going to continue on with the money printing. And at some point, I believe commodity prices will rise regardless of the macroeconomic situation, because simply the growth of the world's population is increasing quite rapidly. And there is some upward mobility in Asia, economic income classes. And so that will lead to greater demand eventually and help to push commodity prices higher. That will be a nice backdrop to the upside for gold. So I'm bullish on the gold market overall. And the only risk I would say for the gold market is if for whatever reason, interest rates do head higher, which is always possible. But if the central banks lose control of the bond markets and no longer able to enforce these ultra low rates, and bond yields start to shoot higher for whatever reason, 0.5% or even 1% higher should something happen, then that would be negative for the gold market. Gold would drop if bond yields rise by 0.5% or more.
Let's talk about another commodity that is holding in a kind of narrow range, which is oil. What's your take on the oil market?
In regards to oil, we've seen U.S. oil production drop about 1 million barrels a day from 9.6 million a day in June of 2015 down to about 8.5 million barrels a day today. So this drop in oil has led to a significant decline in output here in the U.S. That has been somewhat offset by oil supply from Iran, which began selling oil this year. They've increased their sales by 500,000 barrels a day, and they are aiming to increase by another 500,000 barrels a day by year end. So the Iranian increase offsetting the U.S. decline. Other parts of the world have seen declines in production, such as in Nigeria, such as in Libya, and in Colombia, which has helped the oil market to recover from its historic lows of 25 a barrel to approximately 45 today. Other than that, if you're looking at the futures market, the December 2016 contract currently at 47 and a quarter and the December 2017 at 51.20, they suggest that oil will be stable and rise basically towards 50 between now and the end of next year to roughly $50 a barrel. So the futures traders don't see much upside to the oil. I do think that it will go higher or will be stable and rise a little bit. But there's about 3 billion barrels of oil in excess supply around the world. And if the price of oil does go higher, some producers may be inclined to increase their output and also add to the supply pressure. So prediction is, I think we're kind of 45, we should act as sort of a support area, and 52 resistance between now and the end of the year. So I'm slightly friendly on the oil market overall.
So as we close, Gary, you mentioned the one caution that you see is the VIX is almost at an all-time low. It's very at a level of complacency, hinting that anything can rile these markets. What would you be doing right now? Would you be sitting on the sidelines, cautious, or do you think there are some areas of opportunity to employ some money?
I would not buy bonds, generally speaking. I think the yields are too low. On the other hand, I also recognize that they're manipulated, and so one could sit on bonds if they already own them from previous years. I don't think there'll be much of a shakeout. I would say with the stock market, I personally invest in exchange-traded funds with a little bit more diversification, and I'm still positive on the equity markets. I think that area has some room to grow a little bit higher. Now, with the VIX being as low as it is, if there's going to be a shakeout, it won't be more than 3 or 4% on the downside. And then buyers will use that as an opportunity, and the rally would resume to new highs once again. So the VIX is more of a short-term warning sign, but I'm not looking at that as more than a little bit of a pullback and would be an opportunity to add on to some more long positions.
Gary, well, listen, as we close, how can our listeners find out more about the work that you do?
Well, I write a weekly newsletter, comes out every weekend. You can visit my website at globalmoneytrends.com. And you can take a look at some blogger articles that are there. And if you're interested in signing up for the newsletter, you can use that area as well for sign up or call in at any time at the phone number listed.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is Rick Sharga. He's Executive Vice President of 10X. And Rick, let's begin with your overall assessment of the real estate market. We've had some pockets of weakness, but yet we continue to see the market continues to power higher. Home builders are doing good, but we have some choke points in various parts of the United States. Give me your overall assessment of real estate.
I'm probably slightly less bullish than you are. I do think that the market is still in recovery. We went through the most volatile boom and bust cycle in the history of the housing market back in the mid-2000s. And we dug a hole so deep that almost anything looks like improvement from there. But we're continuing to move in the right direction. And the number of existing home sales, the number of new home sales, continue to move in the right direction, despite the fact that there are a number of pretty significant headwinds that keep the recovery from really being a bit more bullish.
Well, markets have been pulling back lately after hitting new records. We have commodities pulling back. Is this just simply a pullback or something else? Joining us on the program is Ned Schmidt. Ned, I want to begin with gold because it has been a stellar performer this year. And in fact, if you're in gold stocks, some of these gold stock indexes are up over 100%. Since then, gold has pulled back. Silver's now below $20 an ounce, and looks like gold is pulling closer to yesterday, or at least on Thursday. Gold got down to 1310 and bounced right back. It's at 1322 as we speak. So what's going on here? What's the reason for the pullback? Is this nothing but a correction, or is this the beginning of something that could be more terminal?
Oh, no. Jim, it's just a correction. I mean, Brexit was the event that never happened, but cash gold got to about 376 intraday, which it shouldn't have never had. So what we're having is a correction down from that. And well, let me come back to silver in a second. But what that is a correction, because right now gold is entering a market environment for a bull market that we have never seen for gold. We have every country in the world trying to debase its currency. Every central bank, maybe I shouldn't say every one. There's probably one we don't know about. But every central bank is trying to reduce the real value of their currencies. And gold is the alternative to totally irresponsible central bank management. I mean, you can't have the ECB trying to lower the euro at the same time the Federal Reserve refuses to raise interest rates. Japan, wherever you go, everybody's lowering the price, trying to lower the real value of their currencies. And they're actually doing what the crazy gold bugs of decades ago used to say. They are destroying the value of fiat money intentionally. Now, part of this recent correction was the nonsense that the Federal Reserve might raise interest rates next week in the middle of the Democratic National Convention. I don't know if they don't have calendars on the street or what. The Federal Reserve is not going to raise interest rates anytime soon.
I don't think they're going to raise in September, 2 months before an election, especially with Yellen being a very staunch Democrat. And the other thing, Ned, and maybe you, whether you agree with this or maybe you agree with it, the one thing I think that surprised the Fed is when they raised interest rates a quarter of a point in December, what happened in the following 6 weeks took the Fed by surprise. So how can they be confident, even if the market is anticipating a greater percentage that they go in September, which I don't think is going to happen, that they can be confident of how the markets would react, especially 2 months before a presidential election, given what happened the last time they raised?
I agree with you 100%. I mean, Yellen is not going to raise rates till after the elections. And Trump is, if he wins, which the probability now has to be 55 or 60%, he's going to fire Yellen. And remember, these clowns that are on the Federal Reserve Board, and maybe I shouldn't use that term, there's got to be one worse. They have no backbones. They're a bunch of academic wimps. They will not take a stand. And Brexit has them scared. And so I agree with you. They're not, we might, maybe a 20% chance get an interest rate increase in December. But I wouldn't look for one between now and then. Now, that means the dollar rally, which has been tremendously weak, is over. The dollar is not going up against anything. All currency values are going down. And that makes all commodities ultimately more valuable. So gold got to, on Wednesday afternoon in the cash market, it got down to about 1315. It was deeply oversold, and at these levels, people should be adding to their gold portfolios. Silver is really a stubborn metal. I was kind of surprised it broke $20 this week. We can't get silver oversold. And I think that is because of cash buying of the silver market. Now, part of this downward pressure had been the commercials, Jim. They got to almost 39 million ounces short, which is an astronomical number in this cycle. And they have started to cover somewhat. But basically what you've had is the commercials selling short into this market, and the speculators have been buying it. So that's where the supply is coming from.
Okay, let me stop you there for a minute, Ned, because commercials are always considered the smart money. The speculators is considered the dumb money. So if the commercials were going short, what were the commercials saying that they would be shorting silver to this extent?
I don't think the term smart money applies to the commercials in the metals markets, in the silver and gold market. They are shorting because the bankers were made them, and they were still so scared that gold would go back down. I mean, their livelihoods were on the line. I mean, if you're an out-of-work CEO for a gold company, what are you going to do? Nothing. And so I think it was more a fear that it would go back down. Because I don't really think we've broken that psychology yet, that people that think gold is going down. They continue to believe that people are going to take their money and throw it in the stock market and never again buy gold. I don't think that's the case. Now, that you mentioned the gold stocks a few minutes ago. I don't think any of us who were bullish in gold expected 150% moves in gold stock ETFs, but it sure did. Now, what we're seeing, and I didn't expect it till the third quarter, Newmont reported, and they just blew the estimate out of the water. The estimate wasn't even in the same ballpark. And so we're already starting to see the second quarter numbers. These gold companies are going to beat the estimates. In the third quarter, it's really going to be dramatic. So investors should not expect anything like we earned in gold stocks the last 6 months. But fear of them collapsing should not be on the table, because they are going to have some of the best earnings surprises for the next year of any stock group. So the returns are going to be a lot less, but they should be positive with gold rising and positive earnings surprises.
Well, it's like anything else. I mean, if you've gone from gold being priced under 1100 as it was in February, silver was down in the $15 range, you go up to 20 and you go up to 1300, that's going to be reflected in, let's say, sales revenue. So margins have obviously increased with the price. But, you know, one thing we should talk about, what makes this a little different, this is what struck me when gold took off, especially in February, is we've had gold rallies in the past. They didn't last long. Silver usually lagged and didn't confirm, and the stocks virtually went nowhere. What we've seen, in many ways, a spectacular result, especially in the gold stocks, has been silver confirming gold and the stocks also confirming. But I want to point out for our listeners, these explosive moves, Ned, that you talked about with many of the gold indexes up over 100%, I think one of the reasons we've seen these kind of returns is this sector is so small. I mean, if you take all the major mining companies, gold mining companies, add them all together, they don't even add up to the market value of, let's say, Coca-Cola. So anytime you get money that flows into the sector, whether it's money going into ETFs like GLD or SLV, or it's going into a gold mutual fund, it doesn't take a lot of money to drive these stocks or the metals up because the sector is so small in terms of market cap.
You're definitely right. People don't understand how illiquid the gold market really is. But, Jim, people are going to be sitting down with their investment advisors this month. The NASDAQ 100 was the hot market of the last 5 years. And over the last year, if your advisor had you in the NASDAQ 100, you basically earned 2% before fees. So after fees, you basically earned zero, which you can do at the bank. And gold's up 20%. I mean, I think people are going to say when they look at their portfolios, having no gold is the wrong position. You know, there's always two positions that are always wrong. That's 0% and 100%. And I think we're going to see people want more gold, and it's not going to take much to maintain the price and move it higher.
So given where we are now, you know, there is this assumption that's being made by the markets that the Fed, because some of the recent strength that we've seen in the employment data and some of the economic numbers, that the Fed is likely to raise interest rates maybe in September. Both you and I believe that this has a lot more to do with talk than anything else. There's no way they've been so reluctant to raise rates. They were going to raise rates. They should have done it back in, let's say, 2012 and 2013, which they didn't do. So the recent rally in the dollar is probably having an impact on metals. When do you think that reverses, Ned? Does it reverse it when the markets wake up and say, wait a minute, we got a Fed meeting next week, and we get some language coming out of that meeting, and they indicate that they're unlikely to go forward? In other words, there's no hint coming out of the meeting that, oh, we're leaning towards raising rates. You hear them talk about it occasionally, but you notice in every single meeting, there's always a reason they don't.
They can always find an excuse not to. And so I think the answer to your question is next week, well, part of it is that next week when they don't raise rates, that expectation will start to die again. At the same time, the economists are starting, they have this belief that Brexit is the end of the world for England and the EU. So they are looking for negative numbers. And there was one of those out, was it this morning or yesterday, on the British Purchasing Manager Index was down sharply. So they're going to start looking for negative numbers on Britain and the UK, and I think that'll change their view and realize the Federal Reserve is not going to do anything.
I want to talk about other commodities. We've also seen a pullback in oil, but overall, if you take the commodity complex, if you look at, I don't care if you're looking at base metals, they're up this year. The ags have been starting to take off. Oil has had a good year after bottoming in February, as the precious metals. So let's move on to the other sectors of the economy. What are the drivers and why is money moving into the ag sector and base metals, especially since we get a lot of weak economic numbers?
Well, the big thing on ag and agricultural prices bottomed in December was the end of the dollar rally. And the dollar, I use a measure of 12 currencies because our ag exports have nothing to do with the euro or the pound or the Swedish krona. Those don't have any effect on it. And ever since December, when the dollar rally died, our export numbers have just started to explode. Now, we report exports in two ways. That grain that has already been exported during the crop year. And remember, the USDA does not use calendar years. Crop year 2016 ends end of August next month. The other number we look at is sales that have been made but not yet fulfilled. And it is those numbers are kind of like the monthly same-store sales for McDonald's. Wheat, which is in a new crop, is in crop year 2017. Our exports sales are up 36%. Actual exports are up 70%. Corn, which the traders now think is going to zero, our export sales are up 42% from a year ago. The soy complex, which is soybeans, oil, and meal, those sales are up 128%. So we're getting ready to see this coming year very strong exports. And right now the traders, commodity traders, are basically ignoring what's going on there. Now, roughly half of the ag commodities have positive price trends. And recently we've had hogs hit a 52-week high because there's a shortage of pork in China. We've had cotton recently hit a 52-week high. We've had sugar hit a 52-week high. Now, I mention those last two in particular because commodities are self-correcting. We are in the second year of demand exceeding production, and that means the shortage situation in cotton and sugar is going to get worse before it gets better. And the sugar situation is interesting because in July, Wilmar International and another company said, all right, you guys, you want to be short these commodities? We'll take them. They took the largest physical delivery of July sugar in 7 years. And I don't think these commodity traders understand that they can get called on to deliver. So Brexit was a factor. Now we have corn, which is really causing some serious problems right now in the short term, because corn had gone from 450 to 350 in about a month. And what that is, we're in a weather market. The weather up until last week in the Midwestern United States was very, very good. And the street thinks that's the way it's going to be all the rest of this summer. Well, one of the oldest rules in commodity trading is that weather markets are always reversed. They always exaggerate them in each direction. So right now we're working through a corn weather market. And what they're forgetting is right now, Jim, in the United States, we have only 45 days of corn consumption in the bins. And we don't even start harvesting it until the first week in September.
When you say only 45 days, how does that compare to an average of what we usually have in storage?
That's a low number. I mean, our absolute inventories are about 2 billion bushels. In 1987, we had 4. And that's what traders are ignoring, is how strong demand is. We're only going to have 30 days of soybeans in the bin next month, and the harvest is 60 days away. And so we're in a far more shortage position when you look at demand. The commodity traders don't look at demand. They just look at the headline numbers. So that's what we're suffering through right now. And what's interesting is China, this will be the first year that China draws down its corn inventories. China has changed its commodity pricing rules, where they used to maintain high prices to support farmers. They have ceased doing that. And the price of corn in China is still $3 a bushel more expensive than ours, but that's down from $9 more expensive. China has decided it makes no sense to pay Chinese farmers twice what the market is when they can just import it from Brazil and Iowa. So the longer-term picture just keeps getting better. And there are some situations in ag. I think people want to look for things that don't require the market to go up right now. We've got Monsanto, who is trading about 106 this morning, and the Bayer bid is 125. Monsanto is saying no, 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 no. I think they want 150, and Bayer can pay it. So that looks interesting. Because of Syngenta and Monsanto being taken off the public market, portfolio managers are looking for other crop protection companies. But right now, the other one is FMC, which is attractively priced. And so investors should hold on Monsanto, because there's still a good gain there, and they should be adding FMC. And that should work regardless of what the market does. The other one, which is a little longer term, you got to think into 2017, is JBS, the big Brazilian meat company. And they're in the process of moving all of their non-Brazilian meat operations to an Irish-based company that will trade in the primary trading of which will be in the USA. So what we will have then is the world's largest animal protein company now trading primarily in the United States. And that is going to be a stock that every portfolio manager is going to have to own, any big portfolio. I mean, you just can't exclude the biggest meat company in the world trading in New York. So I think that it trades now as a ADR, JBSAY. It's very volatile. The chart looks like garbage, but the chart doesn't tell you what's going to happen in the next year. So there are some situations there that investors can look at.
All right. Well, Ned, given that you believe that this is probably a pullback in the commodity complex having to do with, let's say, the recent rise of the dollar on expectations the Fed would be getting more hawkish and raising interest rates, given the fact that you don't think that's going to happen, given where the market is right now, if there was any commodity complex to play, what would be your favorite?
Oh, well, it's still got to be gold. I mean, clearly gold and silver are, as long as the central banks have their attitude that they do, those two metals are a gimme. And I think we're in a gold bull market like nobody can imagine over the next few years. And then look at the special situation that...
Well, listen, Ned, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, you cover two sectors. You cover precious metals and you cover the ag sector, one of the few ag newsletters out there. How could they do so, please?
I've got two sites. One is the ValueViewGoldReport.com, and the other is AgriFoodValueView.com.
Well, that thud, 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 thud sound you're hearing in the distance is probably helicopters approaching, getting ready to do another money drop. At least that's what it seems the central banks are going to be doing. And that's the only strategy they seem to have left right now. So if that is the case, what does that mean for investors? And part of the questions we ask as a part of that is, what are the platforms of the Democratic and Republican parties going to be, and how will that affect investments? And the next question is, are they engaging in fiscal fairy tales and fantasies, given the level of indebtedness that we have, the level of social commitments that we have, and all of the goodies in one form or another that the politicians seem to be promising? And again, what does that mean for investments? What can you anticipate, even if we don't really know what the future is going to be? All of that coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at FinancialSense.com.